Sunsounds listeners, this is Andy Bombic, which means once again it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for a little over 2 months. That also happens to be the 2024 Newbery Award-winning book given to the best children's book every year, titled The Eyes and the Impossible. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Box of Dreams. And then it's Love Made Me More. What Do You Know? The Tunnel. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with The Yellow Handkerchief. So, it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Box of Dreams. Mama was packing up a big box to send to the Philippines. Is this for someone's birthday? I asked. Mama replied, Anik, it's a balikbayan box. It means return to home. And it's how we share our blessings with our family. This box makes me feel closer to them, even though we're so far away. I see a treasure trove of paslabong, ranging from gifts and treats to everyday items and hand-me-downs. We packed jeans and t-shirts for the older cousins, and for the younger ones, some brand new school supplies. The yellow pencils remind Mama of her school days in the Philippines. I was in charge of getting my younger brother and sisters ready in the morning. Then we would meet our cousins on the way to school and trade tales of the great Mayan volcano, while skipping around the rice paddies. Sweet mangoes hung from the trees, just perfect for our snack on the way home. I wish my walk to school was this much fun. Do they have a pool? I ask Mama. No, but they do have beautiful beaches lined with coconut trees and catamarans. We could splash around in the Pacific, sharing pili nut candy and calamansi juice under the sun. Looking around at everything for the box, I wondered what I could share. I ran to my room to look. I'll add my gold star shirt for good luck, my rainbow ruler for good measure, and my pink sparkly jacket for a little glam. I'm sure my cousins will love this. Mama included bags of rice flour for Lola's famous bibingka. When I was growing up, your Lola made the best rice cakes in clay pots for all the family parties and holidays. The sweet scent of Lola's bibingka was calling. Maybe one day I can try it too. The box is filled with such special gifts. Mama, why are you sending toothpaste? I ask. Mama said they really like this kind and it's hard to find there. I wondered what kind they do have. As we close up the box, I sneak in a little something too. It's a wish to travel with the box and fly to the Philippines so I can meet all of my relatives there. I'd go from the big city of Manila, skyscrapers and all, to Mama's home in the province near the majestic volcano with its perfect cone shape. I dream of dipping my toes in the warm tropical waters, tasting sweet and crunchy pili nut candy, and sipping on the delicious tart calamansi juice, just like Mama once did. Along my journey, I'd see boxes connecting families across oceans and lands. Boxes of dreams with different languages and flavors, filled with palasubong, hope and love, returning home to where the heart is. My secret wish is carefully tucked in until one day when Mama and I return home and everyone is together again. Because this is no ordinary box made me more. I'm just a piece of paper, orange with white and blue spots. When a boy folds me many times, giving me a head, tail, and wings, I am his origami crane, and he is my boy. He keeps me on his nightstand. I am the last thing he sees each night, and the first thing he sees each morning. My boy sails me around his room, dipping, diving, dreaming. Sometimes my boy's eyes fill with tears, and he holds me close. His heart goes bump-da-bump against my wings as he talks to me. When shadows fill his room, and the house squeaks and creaks, I protect my boy. On nights when the moon is bright and stars sparkle in the sky, together my boy and I make wishes. But over the years, my boy talks less and less to me. The shadows don't scare him anymore. His picture books disappear. We stop making wishes. I am dusty, but still on his nightstand. And still the last thing he sees each night, and the first thing he sees each morning. One day, my boy places a photograph in front of me. I peek around and see a picture of a girl with an orange, white, and blue shirt. My colors, I fume. Now, she is the last thing he sees each night and the first thing he sees each morning. Years pass, and my boy finds me behind the photograph and picks me up. My wings flutter, and I think we might sail around the room once more, but instead he unfolds me. I'm just a piece of paper again, orange with white and blue spots. My boy scrawls tickling words across my surface and folds me back up. He takes me to the girl in the photo. She unfolds me, and her tears make me soft and damp. "Yes, I will marry you," she says. Now she is my girl too. My boy folds me back into origami crane. On my boy and girl's nightstand, I am the last thing they see each night and the first thing they see each morning. One day, my boy picks me up. He makes other cranes and hangs them from a wire. With me in the center, he tells me they are my flock. The wire spins and we soar. Not long after, my boy and girl place a bundle of orange, white, and blue beneath my flock. My colors, I think, happily. And it's a baby. The bundle giggles and gurgles. My boy and girl smile tenderly, and then I realize it's a baby, our baby. My flock and I are the last thing our baby sees each night, and the first thing he sees each morning. He is ours, and we are his, and he loves us. I realize now that I was never just a piece of paper, orange with white and blue spots. Love has made me so much more. What do you know? When love comes to the well and asks, "What do you know?" I say, "I know thirst. I know abundance. I know depth, I know darkness. When love comes to the farmers and asks, what do you know? He says, I know the colors of the earth's flat face. She says, I know work and weather and the hands of the sun and the rain. When love comes to the honeybees and asks, what do you know? They say, we know the bright heads of the yarrow and the hyssop and the ruffles of the horse mint flowers. And we know the hexagon and the color gold. We know the black bear's hunger for honey. When love comes to the historian and asks, what do you know? She says, I know history speaks when we listen for the quietest stories among the stories. When love comes to the forest and asks, what do you know? It says, I know the color green and the color brown and the billion creatures and creature sounds. I know the call of the monkey, the breath of the bear, the red of the ants, and the shade's dark gown. And I know the musk we make when the rain comes down. When love comes to the ash and asks, what do you know? The ash says, I know the secrets between the volcano and the sky. It says, I know wandering, and I know the language of fire. When love comes to the rock and asks, what do you know? The rock says, I know the force of the water and the force of the wind. And I know that change is possible, even if it takes a million years. When love comes to the goats and asks, what do you know? They say, we know the face of the cliff, and we know the balance of our hooves on the jagged edges. When love comes to the fruit bats and asks, what do you know? They say, we know the sweet of the fruit and the heights of the trees. We know our way in the dark and the clicking of wings. When love comes to the seven sisters and asks, what do you know? They say, we know the silence of outer space and the vastness of the deep, dark night. We know the story of distance and the language of light. When love comes to courage and asks, what do you know? Courage says, I know speaking, even though I am afraid, and I know the daily work of keeping on. When love comes to the seafarer and asks, what do you know? She says, I know the breath of the ocean and the eye of the whale. I know the strength of my muscles as they pull the rope. And I know that star, and that star. When love comes to the land and asks, what do you know? The land says, I know the joy of going on and on and on. And I know the laughter of children who run below the birds, and the heels and toes of the elders who planted the seeds. I know the ancestors and their ancestor dreams, the hoping song that is brown and the hoping song that is green. The tunnel. Something bad happened. I don't like to think about it. Now it's just me and my mom in the quiet house. Mostly I sit in my room and look out the window. Sometimes mom comes in and hugs me tight. I don't always hug her back. People come to visit, and everyone has questions. Tonight, it's Aunt Cheryl. She'll stare at me with her big eyes and ask, "Are you okay?" I don't feel like talking. So I find my plastic shovel, choose a spot, and start to dig down, down into the ground. It's dark down there, but I don't mind. It's crowded, too, with worms and beetles and moles and things I don't know the names of. They don't notice me. Behind me, I hear noises. Distant noises from the house. But I just keep on digging. Then suddenly I surface. I turn around, and there I am, right in our backyard. Through the windows, I see Mom and Aunt Cheryl. I see the nightlight glowing in my room. And then there's the moon between the telephone wires, a spotlight clear and certain. No one knows I'm out here, I tell the moon. I could just disappear. I turn back to the window. Inside, Mom and Aunt Cheryl are talking. I watch them like they're on TV. Mom turns in my direction. She can't see me, but her face looks close enough to touch, almost like the moon. And something shifts inside me. It nudges me like a dog's nose. I could disappear forever, yes, but maybe not tonight. I turn around and start to crawl back the way I came. This time, the worms know me, the beetles too. The moles don't care either way. They have their own work to do. The soil smells sweet and dark. It smells like plants and rotten vegetables. It smells like mud pies and old leaves and basements. I'll go home for now, I tell myself, but I can always come back. The soil turns to carpet, and I tumble forward. My room seems strange and square after the tunnel, but I like it. It's dim and cozy, and it's mine. I cover up the hole and climb into bed. Knock, knock. The door opens, and light shines in the crack. May I come in? Mom asks. Yes, I say. She sits down and gives me a hug. It's gentle and warm and strong. Tonight, I hug her back as hard as I can. Harder. What's this? She asks, picking something from my hair. She holds it out, a crooked little twig. I take it in my fingers. It feels like a bone. I made a tunnel out of here, I say, and then I came back. Mom just nods. I think she knows I need a secret place. She might have a secret place of her own. I think she knows we sometimes travel far away, alone, where we don't have to talk. You came back, she says, and her face is glowing in the soft light, just like the moon. The yellow handkerchief. My abuela wears an old yellow handkerchief that her grandmother gave to her. Abuela scrubs the mud off our patio on her hands and knees. Then she sits quietly on the porch and cleans the dirt from under her nails. I don't like the yellow handkerchief. Abuela carries the eggs from the coop into the kitchen. The smell of homemade chorizo and eggs drifts in the air. My mouth waters. Becca sniffs. What is your grandma cooking for dinner? I'm ashamed to tell her. I wish we had money to buy pizza or take out like Becca's family. I definitely don't like the yellow handkerchief. The oldest, Galina, no longer lays eggs. Abuela plucks the chicken. Why does your grandmother have feathers in her hair? Becca asks. I glance at the chicken coop. My belly will be full, but why can't we buy chicken at the store like everyone else? I can't stand the yellow handkerchief. Abuela works in the garden. She gathers tomatillos and peppers. She moves slowly, but the rows are straight and clear of weeds. Abuela wipes the dirt and sweat from her face. Then she waves her handkerchief to get my attention. Mija, ven acá, adonmen. What did she say? Becca asked. I wish Abuela talked like Becca's grandmother. I have to go, I answer. I despise the yellow handkerchief. Lava monster, lava monster, Becca yells. I accidentally call out safe in Spanish instead of English. I cover my mouth in embarrassment. Becca doesn't understand and springs toward me. I quickly dodge to one side too fast and Abuela slips off her yellow handkerchief and wipes my tears. She kisses my cheek. Sur tu misma, she says, telling me to be myself. That night, she sits on the edge of my bed and sings Dormente mia nieta. When my sister, Mariana, gets a bad cold, Abuela must go live with her sister so she doesn't get sick too. We are all sad. I move into Abuela's room so Mariana doesn't make me sick either. Without Abuela, the room feels so empty except for the handkerchief. In all the rush, she must have left it behind. And then it shows her actually putting it on. The garden is overgrown. I weed the rows. Our new chicken squawks. I collect her eggs. The patio grows dusty. I make it shine. At bedtime, I sing to Mariana. Dormente mia hermanita. I sit on our porch and look out at my work. Without Abuela, I wipe my own tears with the yellow handkerchief. I miss her, and I'm tired of us being apart. And then it shows her running to her Abuela and handing her the yellow handkerchief. Yo amo el pañuelo amarillo. And it shows her Abuela kissing her on her forehead. And here is the author's note. When I was young, there were things I did not understand or appreciate about my Abuela. While my friends' grandmothers wore fancy dresses and drove new cars, my grandmother wore faded house dresses and came to town in an old rusty truck. When she was a little girl, instead of going to school like other children, she'd worked as a maid in a hotel to help support her family. My friends' grandmothers lived in big houses with lawns and flower gardens. My grandmother lived in a tiny, tilting farmhouse surrounded by tumbleweeds and cacti in dusty oil fields. Other grandmas had cats or dogs. Mine had pigs and chickens, and they weren't pets. Their grandmothers bought their food at stores. At my grandmother's table, almost everything we ate came from her yard. My friends ate store-bought hot dogs. We scrubbed pig intestines to make chorizo. They had bookshelves of books and traditional fairy tales. My grandmother didn't have a library full of books, but she never ran out of colorful stories about her family and our history. From her memory, she spoke magical folklore that I'd never find in the books in my school's library. I know now how beautiful, brilliant, interesting, and strong she was. I miss her stories. I miss milking goats and gathering eggs with her. I miss the smell of corn flour in her kitchen while she cooked. I even miss scrubbing pig intestines to make chorizo with her. And I'd give almost anything to see her waving her dirty handkerchief and hear her calling me inside just one more time. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled The Girl Who Planted Trees. Once there was a girl. She was just a small girl, about your size actually. She lived in a dry little village at the foot of a great gray mountain. All day long, the fierce sun scorched the earth, and when evening came, the hot air hung heavily around the houses. One night, unable to sleep, the girl found her grandpa reading a battered old book. "Oh," she gasped, "I wish our mountain was like that." "That is our mountain," sighed her grandpa. "But year after year, the trees have been cut down, and all the animals have disappeared." Sadly, he kissed the girl's forehead, then tucked her back into bed. As she ate her breakfast the next morning, the girl thought to herself, "If only we could bring our mountain forest back." But what could she do? She was just one small girl. Then a tiny idea caught in the corner of her mind. "This fruit grew on a tree," she whispered, "and here are the pips." So she gathered up some things and set off up the mountain. Higher and higher she climbed. The rough path got steeper, and the blistering sun scorched the girl's back. But she did not stop. When, at last, she reached the top, the girl began to dig into the baked earth. There, she buried her pip and whispered a wish. "Please grow, little pip." But when she returned, eager to see what had sprouted, there was not a single bit of green to be seen. "Oh, Grandpa," sighed the girl, "I wanted to grow a fruit tree on the mountain, so I planted a pip. But it was a silly waste of time." "It was a lovely idea," said her grandpa, "but the mountain is too dry for anything much to grow. And besides, a pip can't sprout overnight. It takes days or even weeks." "Oh," said the girl, "in that case, I will plant some more. And this time, I will water them." That afternoon, the girl knocked on her neighbor's door. "I'm going to grow some fruit trees on the mountain," she said. "Can you collect some pips for me?" "Oh my," the woman chuckled. "I've heard everything now." All the same, she picked out 7 large pips from her peelings. And although the girl's other neighbors laughed too, by the end of the week, she had a great number of pips and seeds and stones of every shape and size. 100 seeds will grow. 100 trees," the girl grinned. Weeks passed, and each time the girl climbed the mountain, she imagined she was walking beneath a cool canopy of dappled green leaves. How wonderful it would be. Every day she planted more seeds and watered them well, and soon the seeds began to sprout. even though some withered away under the baking sun, and some were eaten by birds or dug up by animals, the girl did not give up. Until one day, some of the saplings had grown as tall as the girl herself, maybe even taller than you. "Soon I shall grow a whole forest," she thought. Gradually, a small patch of green began to appear on the great gray mountain. It smoothed the frowns from people's foreheads and pulled up the corners of their mouths. Even the girl's grandpa started to feel a little lighter on his tired old legs. Then, one sweltering night, a terrible storm came roaring up the valley. Thunder boomed, lightning ripped across the night sky, and a ferocious wind tore through the house. The girl huddled against her grandpa and sobbed as if her heart might break. "My trees," she cried, "my poor trees." The storm had destroyed them all. At home, the girl and her grandpa slowly began to mend what was broken. Suddenly, the girl noticed something incredible. In the shelter of the barn, a tiny weed stretched its petals to the sun. "Grandpa," she said, "the storm was too much for my little trees, but maybe I could grow them here until they are strong." In the days that followed, they filled their yard with a higgity piggity collection of pots, jugs, and pans. And in each one, a tiny perfect seedling began to grow. But when at last her young trees were ready, the girl became worried. "Our trees are so strong," she said, "but how will I carry them all the way up the mountain?" "You won't," said her grandpa. "We will." So the girl and her grandpa filled a cart and pulled it up the mountain together. At last, all the trees were planted, each tied to a stout stick to protect it from the blistering wind. Still, the girl sighed. "We have worked so hard," she said, "but it will take 1,000 years to cover the whole mountain by ourselves." "It's lucky we are not by ourselves, then," said her grandpa. "Look." And there below, the girl saw a great crowd of people snaking up the mountain path toward them. "Oh, grandpa," she cried, "they're bringing the rest of our trees." "Yours and many more," said her neighbor. "You dreamed that you could bring the forest back. Now your dream is our dream, too." Weeks turned into months, and months stretched into years. And just like the trees, the girl grew tall. She studied hard and learned to care for the land. All the while, everyone worked together to look after the trees and plant new ones. And slowly, the great gray mountain turned green. Until one day, when the girl was a grandmother herself. The mountain was even more wonderful than the picture in her grandpa's old book, more wonderful than anyone could ever have imagined, almost as wonderful as you. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the 2024 Newbery Award-winning book titled The Eyes and the Impossible. Johannes is a free dog, a fast dog, such a fast dog. He lives in an urban park by the sea, and every day he runs through the park, seeing all, missing nothing, and repeating what he sees to the park's three ancient bison, the keepers of the equilibrium. but the equilibrium has been disrupted. Mysterious rectangles are hypnotizing Johannes. The humans are erecting a mysterious new building, and an entirely new kind of animal has arrived in the park. And there are hundreds of them. Johannes must run faster, see better, and ultimately do more than run and see. He must liberate those he loves. Okay, last week, Bertrand the pelican reported to everyone that a bunch of weird animals are near the windmill, and these new creatures were vast in numbers and weed eaters. After being questioned, two furry eaters said they were from the mainland, not the island that they were currently at. The animals aren't sure now if they are on an island. In the meantime, the raccoons, Sonia and Angus, removed Johannes' dog sweater. Johannes is now going to visit the three bison, Freya, Meredith, and Samuel. And that's where I left off last week. I made my way to the bison alone. Their human minders were sometimes nearby in the evening, so I needed to be careful. There was one in particular, a man who watched from and was usually asleep in a hammock near the outer fence, who I had to be mindful of. He was a thin, white-haired man who wore a bright red vest for warmth. I made a wide arc around him and then traveled an unusual route through unknown thickets and irrational paths until I made it to their pen. I found them all lying in a huddle on a far corner with a view of the sea. "My son," said Freya. We nuzzled. "Stay low," she said. "The people are not far." With her head, she pushed me to lie down beside her. Between the three bison boulders, no human could possibly see me. "We worried for you," Meredith said. "I'm proud of you," Freya said. "Your bravery with that child was conveyed to us by Bertrand. I'm so proud, but we miss you." "Your assistants are not good at this job," Samuel said. "Hush," Freya said. "They'll get better. They're trying." "They're not suited to it," Samuel said. "Maybe Sonia," Freya said. "Yes, Sonia is the best at the work," Meredith said. "But you were born to be the eyes." I was happy to be so praised, happy to be missed. "But I can tell you have news," Freya said. "Well, we saw about 100 new animals today," I said. 100 different new animals, or 100 animals, all of one kind?" Freya asked. "Just the one kind. 100 of them, lots of different colors," I said. "They're new. I've never seen them before." The bison asked me to describe the new animals, and I did. Hairy and hooved, with narrow faces and rough-hewn horns. "And you say they ate incessantly?" Meredith said with a smile. "Sounds like goats," Samuel said. I had never heard this word goat. "Oh, we had some here long ago," Freya said, "maybe 1,000 years ago." "At least that long ago," Meredith said. "They did love to eat." "Were their eyes like those of a cat, very bright, very light, and with long, narrow pupils?" Freya asked. "Yes," I said, "their eyes were much like a cat's, but with the pupils going left and right, not up and down." "Yep, sounds like goats," Samuel said. "I think, dear Samuel, that we've established they are goats," Freya said. She turned to me. "How many did you say there were?" "Oh, about 100, I said, but I realized it could have been 1,000 or 1,000. Actually, I thought it could be far more. Oh, somewhere between 100 and 10,000. "And did they say where they'd come from?" I explained the word the goats had used mainland, and how they said we were currently on an island, and that where we lived was very small compared to this other place, the mainland, and how this made me feel very confused and a bit small. Freya's eyes had grown sad. "Oh, I'm so sorry, son," she said. "We do live on an island. I was born on the mainland." She said the word quickly, as one speedy word. "Samuel was born on the mainland, too. But now we're here, and we're happy here. Here is home, and there's no way to leave." Chapter 24. When the goats said this about the mainland, it was one thing. They were cat-eyed strangers who ate prickly plants without pause. But having this new knowledge confirmed by Freya was quite another thing. I sat between them, asking questions, and finally, I was stunned silent. The world beyond this island, they told me, was a million times larger. We lived in a small replica of the mainland, they said, and the rest of the world, they said. There were other mainlands, other islands, so many millions of places, they said. They said all this in whispery tones, knowing the profound effect it would have on me. To have all known boundaries removed, exploded, replaced by a universe of endless elasticity, it is not an easy thing. My mind struggled with this new concept of spatial infinity. And just when I needed most to be with the bison, to bask in their warmth and wisdom, Meredith saw one of their keepers. "He's coming this way," she said. I peeked over the shoulder of Freya and saw a human with a light attached to his head, walking toward us. It was the hammock man. "Run," Samuel said. I got to my feet. "Don't run," Freya said. "Run," Samuel said again. "No, it'll make too much noise," Freya said. "Just slip away. Slink along the fence till you find a hole and scurry through." With the human light coming toward us, I did as Freya instructed. I was free of the hammock man, but I didn't want to go home. I didn't want to be alone with my mind full of these new, troubling thoughts. I found myself walking to the edge of the park with a sliver moon above. Soon, I was staring into the wall of gray human homes with their amber-colored windows and black human silhouettes. I wondered if they knew all this, that they were on an island, far away from everything else. I assumed they did. They had chosen this place. Why? I ran to the ocean and looked out at the waves coming and coming at me. The froth rushed to me on its billion tiny white legs and then crumbled to nothing. I looked into the slate blue night and felt a simmering rage within me. The bison knew all about this, but hadn't told me. They knew that not only were they penned inside a park in a city, but that this city was only one of a billion cities, this one far from anything, some tiny, insignificant island far from anything that mattered. Chapter 25. In the morning, amid the catapulting confusion of my mind, I had no choice but to do my rounds. I was still the eyes. It seemed to be a quiet day in the park, with very few people out and about. This was a work day for the humans, so most were in their boxes sitting still, looking into blue lights, not walking or riding and dancing in the park. It was cold and windy outside, too. A state of affairs that happens often here, given the park's proximity to the sea. So on this windy and cloudy day, I raced through the park, past the peanut pond, and through the eucalyptus forest, and past the lime green waterfall, and I saw nothing unusual, nothing to upset the equilibrium. I was running close to the speed of light, passing by the plaza, when something caught my eye. It was a rectangle on a stick stuck into the grass, and in the rectangle was a dog, a picture of a dog that looked like me. My friends had told me about these pictures, but until now, I had not wholly appreciated the strangeness of seeing one myself. There were words around the picture, and though I cannot read, the meaning seemed clear. The sign was telling people to look out for this dog that I deduced was me. Startled and unnerved, I ran quickly away from the sign, only to encounter another one just up the way from the first one. Well, it was the same sign, same words, same dog. I ran again, this time cutting through the forest near the plaza, so I could get to the other side. I suppose there was part of me that hoped the signs were only in the plaza, only pertaining to that one side of one part of the park. But when I broke through the forest and into the clearing on the other side of the plaza, I saw another sign, another me in the rectangle. And now I added the clues up, and the truth seemed undeniable. These signs were warning people about me. They were telling people I was dangerous or a fugitive of some kind or worse. Could these signs be telling people to catch me, to kill me? Are you there? It was a voice above me. It sounded like Yolanda. I looked up to see that it was indeed Yolanda. She was floating near me, as if she might land on top of me. I am always a bit concerned that because Yolanda's landings are so chaotic, so much wing and beak and bone, that she will land on top of me. She has never done this, I should note, and this time was like all the others. She landed and gave me nothing more than the gentle breath of her folding wings. "Did you see the signs?" she asked. I told her I did, and before I could express my bewilderment at being represented all over these signs, all over the park, she said something strange. "No, no," she said. "These are new. These are different. These say that there's a coyote in the park." "Is that really what the signs say?" I asked. "Yep, look," she said, and swept her gray wing under a series of symbols, apparently those that meant coyote. Yolanda knew I could not read, knew that only she could read, and yet she seemed to hold out hope, eternal hope, that by occasionally pointing to some collection of symbols, we'd suddenly learn to read as she could. It was a little bit irritating, to be honest. "Oh," I said and nodded. She smiled. I was very intrigued by this new development, the possible existence of one or more coyotes in the park. I had heard of coyotes, but only as a long-ago species. Coyotes were known as a mangy and troublesome and even dangerous kind, and as far as I'd known, they had been driven out by the humans thousands of years ago. "So you haven't seen one?" Yolanda asked. It took me a moment to realize that this put in question my competence as the eyes. If the humans, being so clumsy and oblivious, had seen coyotes before I had, what credibility could I claim? "I haven't," I said. "I could not lie. I will not lie." "Well, I guess "We have to be on the lookout," she said, and then, with a few flaps of her heavy wings, she drifted off. I was left a bit stunned, thinking that an entirely new, or old, kind of animal was among us, a dangerous and troublesome sort of animal that looked, from a distance, a bit like myself. It was all very confusing. "There he is," said a voice. It was a parks person on a bicycle. She was riding toward me, with a second parks person riding a bit behind her. The first one pedaled toward me. I had to chuckle briefly to myself because they seemed to think they would catch me by simply riding toward me. These people. Ha, ha, hoo! They do make me laugh. Bicycles are funny jokes to me. They give me laughs and chuckles and sometimes even giggles. Bicycles are as statues are to rockets, with me being the rocket. Now, the two bicycle people were getting off their machines. They believed they had caught up to me due to their great speed. Oh, the hilarity. Ha, ha, hoo! Now, they were coming at me from either side, slowly, with their arms out like those of crabs. It really was sad how much they really believed they could capture me this way. Two people with their slow legs and little hands and their shiny mushroom hats on their heads. I waited, because I am mischievous with creatures who think they are fast. Sometimes I wait until they are close to me, to tease them, to make them feel they have a chance. In this case, I waited until I could feel the heat from their little hands and could see their wide-open eyes. They were so excited. Then I bolted. They blinked, and I was 100 feet away, laughing to myself, shaking my head. "Where is he?" the one asked. "Over there," the other said. "How did he get over there?" "He was just here." Those people, they blinked again, and I was away again, double the distance. Oh, I have fun. I have fun with people like this. And then the first one spoke into a black device for a time, and then the two of them got back on their bicycles and headed toward me again. It was funny. It really was. But one can only play with such people for so long, and there is always the outside possibility that such play would bring about more control the animal's people, and possibly unusual or new weapons. And anyway, I had things to do. I owed the bison an update soon, and I had yet to see what was happening with the goats, a topic about which they would want updated information. When I got near the windmill, as I was slowing from light speed to mortal speed, I could see the vast mass of hair that was the goat army. They were eating just as they were eating the day before, all of their heads down and their jaws pumping and their eyes dead to all other stimuli. The day was overcast and windy, but there was one shaft of light just then as I approached. And this one shaft of light ended on the silvery gray back of a certain goat, who was away from the rest, and who was looking exactly at me. "Hello," she said. I could not believe she could see me. I was 100 miles away or so, and I was hidden amid a blackberry thicket and beyond a forest of redwoods. "I see you," she said. I decided to emerge. "You weren't very well hidden," she said, which normally would have stung, would have pierced my heart. But there was such good cheer in her voice, such gentleness and humor, that I found myself smiling. She was so immediately appealing that I couldn't help asking her why she was so far from the rest of her group, eating all alone. She said her name was Helen. I had never heard this name before, but it sounded both regal and smooth, like a trickle of warm water, and thus far she herself seemed both regal and smooth, like warm water. So why was she so apart and so alone? "Oh, gosh," she said, "they wouldn't want to talk to me. I don't blame them. Look at me. I'm a freak." I looked at her carefully. To me, she looked like all the other goats, and I told her so. "You don't have to be polite," she said. "I'm used to scaring everyone around me. I'm horrible, a monster, a blight." Again, I told her I couldn't figure out what it was that she thought so unusual or frightening in her appearance. She said, "For starters, my horns." She tilted her head to me to afford me a better look. I examined them closely and still saw nothing out of the ordinary. "Oh," she said, laughing, "I forgot you don't have goats here, and maybe you're not so good at observation." Now, it was me who had to laugh. She didn't know I was the eyes. This was very funny to me, so I allowed myself a good long chuckle while shaking my head. "Ha ha, whoo!" "What's funny?" she asked before I answered. I had to do one last ha ha, whoo, just to demonstrate the ridiculousness of her suggesting I was not so good at observation, which was evidence that she was not so good at observation. I had to tell her, as humbly as I could, that I was not only good at observation, but that I was so good that I was basically in charge of all seen in the park. "Well, congratulations," she said, and seemed very sincere in saying it. "That sounds like a lot of responsibility." I nodded, grateful she recognized this. "But your powers of observation," she said, "make it all the more puzzling that you can't see my glaring defects." And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the fascinating novel titled The Eyes and the Impossible. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.